Good afternoon, everyone. I have one edit to the title. We're not calling it a U.S. representative sample. We're just calling it a U.S. national sample. And I do want to thank my co-authors, most all of whom are in the room. So Brian upstaged me, and everything I was going to say, he said. So this will just be repetition, and it's for learning. I'd like to refer to what we know about STIs as sort of being like the other epidemic, because we talk a lot about HIV, and I think Brian did an exceptional job of selling why is it so important to look at STIs as well, not for the value of just looking at STIs, but also the connection that STIs can have with HIV transmission. Brian talked about the STD Surveillance Network, which is 42 STD clinics within 12 collaborating jurisdictions. And in their data, so for instance, gonorrhea prevalence was 16.9%. The 27.4% of them were among gay and bisexual men, though. And if you're looking at a population that probably represents between 4 and 15% of the U.S. population, that's very evident of a disparity. And as Brian said, the most common methods for detecting STIs is going to be through a nucleic acid amplification test. And as Brian said, there currently is not one really available for rectal testing. So STD clinics have to establish their own controls. So it's not really something that's very accessible to lots of people throughout the United States, and including something like for at-home use. And a lot of, as Brian said, the testing that we've done has been on urine. We haven't paid a lot of attention to rectal testing at all. And with rectal testing, it's a much more invasive procedure. You know, with urine, it can be self-administered collection in private. With rectal STIs, it can be self-administered, or it could be provider-administered to collect the sample. And there has been some sampling studies looking at self-sampling in clinic-based populations, and they did find high viability and acceptability with various populations, including men who have sex with men. So it might be okay to let people sample themselves. Unless you're a doctor that's really into sampling. Gay and bisexual men and other men who have sex with men engage in high rates of both insertive as well as receptive sex. But we don't talk about receptive sex a lot. And if you look at pretty much anyone's data, you can see there's high rates of people that engage in insertive, receptive, and in insertive and receptive sex. And I don't think David Moskowitz is in the room, but he did some really great work around looking at the association between someone's identity as a top, bottom, or versatile and their actual sexual behavior, and there is a disconnect there as well. So simply asking someone, are you a top, bottom, or versatile, may not be sufficient to know what their sexual behavior was. Much of our attention to gay and bisexual men and other men who have sex with men has been grounded in HIV prevention for a very good reason. And a lot of that work as well has also been grounded in urban epicenters. So we don't know as much from people who don't live in New York, Chicago, Miami, Atlanta, Los Angeles, San Francisco, etc. A lot of what we know as far as STDs are concerned usually comes from STD clinics, which is great surveillance data. But the problem is that you're potentially inflating the percentage of people who actually have an STI, because you have people that are going to seek treatment or referred for treatment. And surveillance data is not collected for, it's not research, it's surveillance. So some of the rich contextual things that you might get with regard to psychosocial factors or other demographic characteristics may not be collected in that setting. So we can only learn so much from surveillance data. There has been a lot of researchers have transitioned to using the internet to collect their data as well as identify their samples, and that's really been in response to the sheer number of gay and bisexual men that use the internet, as well as using the internet for meeting potential sex partners. So it's become a really increasingly acceptable approach. And recent studies have been combining online data collection or studies that would have been entirely online with some type of biological component as well, where we're mailing a kit to someone and they're submitting a sample to us. Most of that work has been done with HIV testing, sending people at-home kits to either collect a blood sample or doing a rapid antibody test. And it's what we did in our study. We actually had participants do the rapid test and then take a picture of the paddle and send that to us. But we don't know so much about the use of self-administered testing for STIs. But what we do know is that it is feasible and it is acceptable. So the study that I'm going to talk about today is going to look at the rates of urethral and rectal chlamydia and gonorrhea, diagnoses in a U.S. national sample of HIV-negative gay and bisexual men, as well as factors that were associated with diagnoses. I passed out the tables that I'm going to show because you may not be able to see them. I don't have enough flyers for everyone. I misunderestimated how many of you there would be. So those of you in the back probably won't be able to see the screen, and you probably didn't get flyers either. And that's your punishment for sitting in the back. The data that I'm going to present come from a study that we call 1,000 Strong. Its government name is Endemics and Resilience for HIV Transmission in a National Sample of Vulnerable Men. Jeff Parsons and I are the principal investigators of this study, and I do want to recognize the many members of our team who make the study happen. And we were funded by NIDA. Thank you, NIDA. Oh, I have no financial disclosures either while we're on money. The participants in our study were recruited with, we partnered with a recruitment firm called Community Marketing and Insights. CMI maintains a database of 45,000 LGBT individuals who participate in online studies, traditionally for marketing purposes. So if Pepsi wants to know what lesbians think about Diet Pepsi, you know, they would go to CMI to get those data. We called CMI and said, we want to identify participants from your panel, and we want you to give those participants to us. So CMI screened potential panelists for initial eligibility, and those that consented and were eligible for our study had their contact information then shared with us, and we independently pursued them for the study. To be eligible for our study, you had to live in the United States and have a U.S. mailing address. Be over the age of 18, have been assigned male gender at birth and currently identify as male, self-identified as gay or bisexual, able to complete our assessments that were in English, have access to the internet, have a device that was capable of taking digital pictures, so either a smartphone or a digital camera, self-identify as HIV negative, and be willing to complete at-home self-administered rapid HIV antibody testing, as well as collect samples for urethral and rectal STI testing, and to have reported having sex with another man in the past year. What's interesting about this sample is that we don't have a risk criterion to get in, so they didn't have to report unprotected anal sex within a certain time period in order to get into this study. So what we'll end up showing is the rates of gonorrhea and chlamydia were a little bit lower than what Brian identified, but it's important to note that in Brian's sample, there was a unprotected sex in the last 6 months criteria for that study, so that may explain part of the difference. Here is a heat map showing the distribution of participants in the 1,000 Strong panel. This distribution closely mirrors the population distribution in the U.S. We did not get anyone from North to South Dakota.
Neither of the two gays there would fill out our survey.
Yes, they were busy. What I will say as well, so in partnering with CMI, we used census data on this distribution of same-sex couples and gave those parameters to CMI to tell them that as they were inviting participants to participate in our panel, that we want our panel to look like the distribution of same-sex couples across the United States. It's not the census is not the best mechanism, but it is one of the best. Because the census does not collect data on sexual identity, you have to go with the same-sex households. At baseline, participants completed at-home CASI for us, and then we would mail them a kit. They would self-sample themselves for HIV testing, which I won't talk about. They would photograph the paddle and then upload that photo to us. And the dates are incorrect here. The data were collected in 2014, between April and October. We did an STI test, trust us. We gave our participants a video to watch to help explain it. I'm told that the audio will work on this. For those of you that are shy, you will see some booty. Much like this doesn't have presenter mode, the internet is also very fast here.
Now, let's do the rectal test. It may seem intimidating, but it's really quite easy. You're just going to take this package, you're going to open it up, and you're going to remove the swab. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
What you're going to do is you're going to take the swab, and from the top, you're going to go about an inch and a half down, and you're going to hold it with your fingers. Then you're going to insert the swab into your butt until your fingers touch your butt, so that it doesn't go in too far. You're going to give it a little twist, and then pull it out.
That was easy.
So what we're going to do next is we're going to take your swab, and we're going to insert it into the tooth. You put the Q-tip side into there, and then if you bend the tube, it'll snap right off. Perfect. Now seal the tube. Put the tube in the bag with the other tube. You're going to seal this up. You're going to include the instructions that have the date that you collected the specimen. Put it in the box.
All right, thanks. So that was part of a much longer video that also explained the HIV testing, but that's what we gave to participants as well. During enrollment, so when we were trying to get people to enroll in the study, there were some participants that we mailed a kit and never got it back from them, or they never submitted it to the lab. 26 participants failed to complete the the STI testing component. We had 7 guys whose samples came back inconclusive, and our attempts to resample these individuals were unsuccessful. Among the 1,071 participants that we got into our study, we had 2.8% sampling error, and that's where the lab reported back to us that the tube came open during transport. There was fecal contamination on the swab. We had one participant who confused his HIV test paddle and used that to sample himself. Less than 1% of kits were reported as lost in the mail. In all instances, we successfully resampled these individuals, even our scooper. Here's the some demographic characteristics of the participants in our study. 95% were gay identified. The majority were white as well, but bear in mind that these characteristics look like what people in the United States look like. And they're all they're all confirmed HIV negative. So we had a lot of black and Latino men who wanted to join our study, but because we were only recruiting HIV negative individuals and the known disparities in HIV, those individuals were not eligible for the study. And I'll just move on. Almost all of our participants had health insurance. 76% said that they had a primary care provider. Substance use was rather low, but it depends on whose metric you're using, so 10.8%. 39.2% reported condomless anal sex with a casual male partner or an HIV-positive main partner or a main partner who said they didn't know their status in the prior 3 months. Almost half of participants said that they did not have any anal sex in the past 3 months. And then the next numbers, they're among all participants, not the anal active participants. 12% said that they their anal acts were strictly receptive, 20% insertive and receptive, 17.6% only insertive. In total, we had 6.2% of our participants test positive for an STI, and our rectal STIs were more common than urethral. And at first it's like, 5.3, 1.7, that doesn't seem huge, but we're talking 48 men that had just a rectal STI of the 66 participants that tested positive for an STI. So that's a very huge gap between where we were finding our diagnoses. These are our participants that had STIs. And then here's the tables that I handed out to you. And I'm just going to skim through this, but for those of you that are curious who had gonorrhea, who had chlamydia, who had gonorrhea plus chlamydia, rectal, whatever, it's all right here broken down for you. We looked at factors that were associated with testing positive for rectal gonorrhea or chlamydia, and that's what you're seeing right here, and then I'll separately talk about urethral. So being diagnosed with rectal GC or CT was associated with having a lower income, being single, which makes sense. Latino men were significantly more likely, had a significantly greater odds than white participants to be diagnosed. It was not associated with having health insurance or a primary care provider, so it's not like they weren't getting care, if that makes sense. And it was associated with doing drugs. When we look at behavioral factors, everything here makes complete sense. People that were having sex without condoms and people that were having more sex were more likely to be diagnosed with a rectal STI. Insertive acts was significantly associated with being diagnosed with a rectal STI. When we look at urethral STIs, I will posit one caution. We had fewer people that had urethral STIs, so we have less power to look for significant differences. With regard to demographic characteristics, nothing came up being associated with having a urethral diagnosis. Pretty much the behavioral variables were associated. So having more partners, having more sex without condoms was associated with being diagnosed with a urethral STI. So participants completed at-home self-administered STI sample collection and mailed those to a lab for analysis with minimal errors, which tells us that we have high feasibility and acceptability for incorporating at-home self-administered STI sample collection into studies that would have otherwise been fully online. Oh, one quick caveat. The incentives that we gave to participants, it was $25 for completing our first hour-long at-home CASI. Then we mailed them a kit in the mail once they completed that. And when we got the kit back and the results, you know, were returned to us as being valid results, we then sent participants another $25 in the form of an Amazon gift card. In our study, 6.2% tested positive for rectal or urethral chlamydia or gonorrhea, with rectal STIs being far more common than urethral. Our rates are lower than CDC surveillance data, but that makes sense because that's coming from STD clinics. I think Brian came up with maybe better reasons about why we're having rectal STIs than urethral, but here are the five I came up with, which is some overlap. So why are we finding that rectal STIs are going undiagnosed? Why is it so much higher than urethral? And it could be an individual's own failure to recognize the symptoms of a rectal STI infection relative to the more pronounced symptoms of a urethral one. It could be that there's lower acceptability, both by patients as well as providers, of the methods by which samples for rectal STIs are collected. It's a lot easier to collect urine than it is to stick a swab up someone's butt. Both patients and providers may have discomfort around discussing sexual behavior and sexual health, particularly anal sexual health. There may be a failure on behalf of medical providers to suggest or provide rectal STI testing to their gay and bisexual male patients as part of his routine medical care, as well as a failure on behalf of the patient to request it. And there could be insurance, and I don't know if this is true, there could be insurance coverage gaps as well, where maybe some tests are covered, but others are not. And I would say, like, one thing I wish we collected, but we didn't. We didn't ask our participants how frequently they get STI testing, so we don't, or if the participants perceived that they had an STI going in. Because it would have been really interesting to see how many people said, nope, everything's fine down there, and then they end up coming up STI positive. In our study, STI diagnosis appeared to be more so, I'm jumping a little bit ahead. We also ran some multivariable models, which I have not reported here, and I will say that some of the demographic characteristics end up dropping out when we run multivariable models. And what happens is it's really the behavioral factors, so having more sex partners, having sex without a condom, that's really driving the who's getting diagnosed with an STI and who isn't. And although it may seem counterintuitive that receptive condomless anal sex was associated with the urethral diagnosis, we highlight that receptive condomless anal sex was positively correlated with insertive condomless anal sex. And so we have a couple of... Okay. We recruited participants based on U.S. Census data distribution, which is not the best. We don't use sample weights in this. I'm not going to go into why, but we have very strong reasons for why we shouldn't use sample weights. Other methods for STI detection exist that we didn't use in this study, and we did not assess for other STIs other than chlamydia and gonorrhea. And because this is an internet-using sample, it may be more tech-savvy than what you would find in maybe a community-based sample. My closing thoughts are that we need to start testing for rectal STIs, and our finding that insertive condomless anal sex was associated with rectal diagnosis highlights the importance of providers just to screen patients for a full range. Or I like Brian's suggestion as well, which is just maybe we should just start testing for rectal, and that's going to cover it. We have a lot of people to acknowledge. Thank you. And thank me.
That was a great presentation. Is there any one or two follow-up questions from the audience?
A burning question.
Okay. Yes. So the question is if you notice any difference by region in the infection rate.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember, but we have the data, so I can answer that question for you.